We are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Nagler. Peace Paradigm Radio explores the power of active nonviolence. As Gandhi said, nonviolence is not the inanity that it's been taken for throughout the ages. It is actually a science, it has a history, and a strategic logic, and that's what we like to explore on the show. Today is Friday, August 5th, 2016, and we have a very interesting show on the way, including discussion with a peace team trainer and member, Elliot Adams, who has been on the show before to talk about his experiences at the Republican National Convention on the peace team. And then we're going to turn to Netra Halperin, who was a former Bernie Sanders delegate and is now a supporter of the Green Party, Jill Stein. And just a caveat, the Peace Paradigm Radio on KWMR, we're not supporting any one particular candidate or party because that's not our role in educational radio as we do here at KWMR. But it should be still an interesting conversation, and it is interesting to hear from those who we have on the show. So let's go ahead and get started with Elliot Adams. Thank you for joining us today, Elliot, on Peace Paradigm Radio.
It's wonderful to be with you on a show that's doing very important work.
As you said, it's a good day, except for the fact that we're living in a war culture. So, Elliot, let's start off a little bit about you and your background. You are a member of the Meta Peace team, and you have a very rich peace history behind you. Can you talk a little bit about who you are and what kind of work you do in the world?
Sure. I mean, it's funny to say a rich history of peace since I started out in the military as a young man, volunteered for the Army, volunteered to be a paratrooper, volunteered for Vietnam, served in Vietnam, Japan, Korea, Alaska, went to Grenada after we invaded Grenada, spent time in Gaza after Operation Cast Lead, et cetera, et cetera. But I think for me, anyway, it is that military experience. It is having seen war close up and near that helped me understand that many of the things we think can be accomplished somehow through war can't, and that and from that I learned that many of the things we want to accomplish can be accomplished through active peace work.
That's right, and so I think that is a rich history, Elliot Adams, because you are coming from a very informed perspective, and you've gotten involved in peace teamwork, which has such a promise to replace the war system because it offers a really constructive way of de-escalating conflict and helping people get to really the root of what they're trying to say to one another and get their needs addressed. Can you talk about your work in peace teams and then what brought you to the Republican National Convention?
So peace teams, I think, are very much of an answer. They clearly are a way. So at Meta Peace Team, we think of a couple of things. One is we believe that conflict is normal. Conflict is what is natural. Conflict is what gives me permission to be an individual. Conflict is what we will get if we have diversity. So conflict is normal and natural. But what is not natural and what is not normal and what is not necessary is violence in conflict. And then we believe that in TIPNI, third-party nonviolent intervention, which I'm sure you've talked about before, we believe that third party individuals can help reduce the violence in other people's conflict. So that's the essence of peace teamwork, is whether it be individuals working with individuals or groups working with groups, we can help reduce the violence in conflict.
Yeah, thank you, Elliot. Now, because third-party nonviolent intervention has been systematized into peace teams, but it's something that we encounter in our daily lives all the time, I believe, even in our families, you know, where somebody might intervene. They're not taking sides, but they love both parties and they want to see a resolution worked out. So is there anything else that you can say about the promise of peace teams in terms of helping us to get to that place where you said where conflict is normal but violence is not?
Well, I think one of the things we know, and it's almost self-evident, is that as violence increases in a conflict, mm-hmm. so too, as violence increases in a conflict, it is likely to continue increasing as each party tries to outdo the other party. But we also know that the opposite is true, too, which is that as violence decreases in a conflict, it makes room for it to decrease more and more and more. So that process of helping even an incremental decrease in violence is a really important role. And as you say, we can do this work within a family. There are daily opportunities just walking down the street where you can see conflict, and as an individual, you can step in and change the balance, reduce the likelihood of violence on a personal level as well as at a greater level. But if you can do it so it can also be done at essentially the levels that armies can be done at. You can do it I've done a fair amount of work in the West Bank and in Palestine trying to help reduce the violence. We just certainly haven't solved that problem, but as you reduce the violence, you increase the probability, the likelihood, the possibility that resolutions can be found, or even that people can continue to live in that conflict. My wife refers to it as our conflict partner. And in truth, when we are in conflict with somebody, we really are in a partnership. We are in a journey together. We are journeying along, and we are journeying along together just because we are in conflict with them. So that seeing that conflict as a journey and recognizing that it can be a journey which is interspersed with conflict or one which is not interspersed with violence, or one which is not interspersed with violence, is an important idea. And indeed, I would suggest that that if you're on this journey together with your conflict partner, as long as you journey along, you are likely to come to resolutions, as long as there isn't violence. But once violence gets introduced, then the chance of coming up to any kind of resolutions, any kind of compromises, any kind of understandings gets radically decreased. And that's true of violence at the level of war. That's true of violence at the level of insults. At any level, that reduces polarizes the situation and reduces the chances of coming to a conflict. Mm-hmm. Coming to some kind of a resolution of your conflict.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're talking with Elliot Adams, a member of the META Peace Team, who was present at the Republican National Convention on a peace team. And right now he is giving us a bit of background into what third-party nonviolent intervention is to contextualize a bit of what he's going to say next. Elliot Adams, can you talk about what you did at the Republican National Convention? There was a peace team there. Why were you guys there? And can you give us a story about what you saw happen?
So I think it's important and almost impossible at this point to remember what it was like before the start of the RNC, mm-hmm. The Republican National Convention. As I prepared to go, many people told me it was too dangerous to go. It's important. There were many articles about how people were canceling their hotel reservations because they were afraid it was going to become too dangerous and too scary. There were many discussions I heard of law enforcement agents that were coming to the RNC to help support the Cleveland police who expected to see Armageddon, and they used that term.
Wow.
There were police forces which actually changed their mind and refused to go. When I got there a number of days ahead of time because it helps to get your feet down, get to know the players, the organizations, get to be known in order to be effective in an area. Much of the community was talking about, you know, how they are going to rebuild from the ashes of Cleveland after what was going to happen in Armageddon. It was going to happen during the RNC because it was people were expecting a terrible, terrible situation to happen.
Mm-hmm. And what happened?
So that's why I went.
Yeah,
I went because I felt that peace teams are. That's where. Peace teams are most important in risks in places where there's a risk of high violence. So that's why we went. Now, it didn't turn out that way at all. It turned out very peaceably, and I think a lot of things were involved. I think that while the peace teams didn't actually do a lot of reduction of violence because of the situation. I think that we had a big impact. It was interesting to watch police officers thank us for being there. Mm. And I think that, again, helped lower their tension, both because they thought we might help reduce the violence, also because they thought it showed that organizers were interested in keeping down the violence, and that lowered their level of tension. Which, of course, is an important part in reducing violence, lowering people's edginess and their nervousness. More people, individual people, thanked me for being, or thanked us, the peace team, when I was visibly a peace team member, thanked us for being there than in, I think, any other group I've been involved in, any other demonstration. I'm sure any other demonstration I've been involved in.
And so that this is very interesting. You guys were dressed with vests. You were clearly identifiable as a peace team, not as, you know, peace officers, you know, to protect only one side, but to help reduce violence on either side. And you had also mentioned that the police weren't out there in their armored vehicles this time. They were on bicycles and on foot. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think an important part of this process was a difference, what I would call the Cleveland model of policing as opposed to the Miami model of policing. And clearly there was an intent by it. So it's important also to understand that Cleveland had been through, it was under an order, a consent order, because they had been, they had a bad record. And so for a few years now, they've had a committee of very smart people, religious leaders, leaders in the community have been working with the police, trying to reduce the violence of the police and trying to change the modeling of police. So if we compare what I see as antithesis, the Miami model and the Cleveland model, the Miami model was one, if you recall, of civil rights repression. They started out by repressing people's rights to start with, and then they came out with very aggressive, dominating police presence, which they felt intimidated anybody from becoming violent. From my experience around those situations, it increases the tension, it increases the violence, so that as the police are being very aggressive, it makes the general tone of the demonstrations much more edgy, much more angry, much more feeding injustice. And one of the things I think is really important to see in these dynamics, in the dynamics of trying to keep peace, is that if you take the classic example of an agent provocateur, whether it be just a a person, or whether it be somebody who was paid for by government officials or some such thing, an agent provocateur by themselves is really of no importance, because so you have one person causing trouble, throwing a stone. The problem comes when they become very effective when they have a seething, angry mob. When the crowd is edgy, the crowd is feeling that they've been that they're being treated unjustly, seeing that the police are unfair. That's when the agent provocateurs become effective. Whether they be one of the revolutionary groups trying to be a vanguard, trying to start the revolution, or whether they be a crazy individual, that they need to have that seething, angry mob. And one of the things that I think happens by having a peace team presence, by having police that are out in short sleeves and bicycles, mm-hmm. is that it reduces that the level of anger. In fact, I even noticed that there were less sirens, and that just a constant sound of sirens you sometimes hear around demonstrations increases that level of tension. The constant buzzing by helicopters increases that mm-hmm. general level of tension, which is really valuable for creating a riot, creating a a violent uprising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I saw groups that I know would have been very, very happy to have seen a riot, a violent uprising, who were, I can remember one guy I know pretty well who was just sitting on the street corner telling stories. There wasn't anything for him to do,
mm-hmm.
Because there wasn't that angry mob that was ripe material for starting trouble.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Elliot Adams. We're going to turn now to Netra Halperin, who was just at the Democratic National Convention to look at both conventions. But if for people who want to learn about the kind of work that Elliot's talking about, that Elliot Adams was talking to us about, peace teams, Elliot, can you tell them how to get involved?
So we are Meta Peace Team, M-E-T-A Peace Team. You can visit our website, metapeaceteam.org. And, of course, there's also the Shawnashenian Network, which you may want to talk about some too, Stephanie.
Absolutely. And we hope to have you again on the show, Elliot. Thank you for your time today.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. Let's turn now to Netra Halperin, who is a former Bernie Sanders delegate, now supporter of Jill Stein and the Green Party. And she's going to talk to us a little bit about her time at the Democratic National Convention here on Peace Paradigm Radio. And I'm going to turn this interview over to you, Michael Negler.
Thank you, Stephanie. Netra, hi, good to speak with you again. Could you tell us, I guess let's start here. What brought you to Philadelphia?
I was a Bernie Sanders delegate. I wanted to support Bernie. There was, of course, a very slim chance by the time we actually headed off for Philly that Bernie would be the nominee. But I wanted to be there, stand by him. There was so many talk of different things, scenarios that could happen. So I went to support him. He also reinforced how important it was that we were there to do the roll call vote. So I, checked the box at our breakfast meeting of who I supported, and that I did that. So that's what brought me there.
I see. And were you involved any in the events outside the DNC?
That's a really interesting question. I did not even know until the second day that there were events outside the convention. This whole free speech zone concept, of course, is kind of Orwellian, because that's supposed to be a part of our constitution, that we all have free speech. So the FDR Park was far enough away. It wasn't physically that far away, but I actually tried one evening because I was on the text with Gloria Materis, the campaign manager of Jill Stein, who said, oh, we're over at FDR Park. Come on over. I could not get there. I got in a Uber, and we drove around the block. It took an hour to drive around the block, and we ended up exactly where we had started. So because of all the barricades, it was literally impossible for me to get to the other activities.
Naturally, that really is frustrating. I can see that as kind of symbolic.
It's extremely symbolic. They did not want the delegates or the news media to know the extent of demonstrations and unhappiness with the actions of the DNC.
Netra Halperin, where do you think this frustration and unhappiness is going to go now?
Well, let me talk about a little bit about what the exact frustration is.
Of course.
I helped with some attorneys in California who filed lawsuits against the Secretary of State, Alex Padilla, who was a Hillary Clinton fundraiser and supporter, which is very bizarre that he, as Secretary of State, who is in charge of the elections, is allowed to do that. And also against Michael Vu, who had been the registrar of voters in Ohio in 2004 during the Bush-Kerry race, and he had thrown that election. Two of his underlings were actually convicted of felony election fraud. Of course, they didn't turn on him, I'm sure due to fear, like our previous speaker spoke of. But he then was apparently phoned by San Diego voter registrar's office saying, hey, come work for us. You obviously have our style. You know, someone that knows how to steal elections. So I helped with that. And I know I made several videos on that, several three-minute clips about whiting out votes and shredding ballots. So for me, the anger was because of all the fraud and voter suppression. And then, of course, everybody knows, and it is now widely acknowledged, that the DNC worked hand in glove with the Clinton campaign. And I run for office. I ran for state house representative in Hawaii. And it is very clear the DNC, the Democratic Party, does not support one candidate or another before the primary has been completed. And then, of course, they support whoever wins. So that's completely unethical. My Congresswoman, Tulsi Gabbard, she was the vice chair of the Democratic Party. And she, after a couple months, stepped down and said, I can no longer stay neutral. I want to support Bernie Sanders, so I'm going to step down from my position. Unfortunately, Debbie Wasserman Schultz did not have those ethics. And so she continue to support Hillary Clinton, of course, in conjunction with the mainstream media. So between all of that jerry-rigging thing for one candidate and the actual voter suppression in numerous states and election fraud of the machine, it appeared that Hillary Clinton won, but I do not believe, and there are reports stating this, that she actually did get the popular vote.
Thank you, Netra. For those just tuning in, that was Netra Halperin, who was a delegate for Bernie Sanders and who survived the DNC in Philadelphia. And Netra, it seems to me then that there are two kind of pathways going forward. One is there might be a legal battle to determine whether or not there was in fact fraud of some actionable kind within the party. But then there are also the Bernie supporters who are going through a crisis of deciding now where do they go from here. Could you comment on either or both of those?
Regarding the legal battle, my understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is that the way that Bernie Sanders handled things, in that he did not ever concede and he did not release his delegates. I'm a delegate. He never said to us, you are released. And then he did endorse, of course, Secretary Clinton as per party rules. My understanding is that for him to run as a Democrat, that was one of the agreements that he would make. And so, according to my sources, because he handled things in precisely that way, if something happens to Hillary Clinton's candidacy, which, you know, in my understanding, she has committed so many different crimes that basically they got to catch her on something. If they do, then Bernie Sanders would become the nominee. And this is really important because, of course, the DNC does not want Bernie Sanders. So if it's given back to the leadership in the party, even though he got second place, they wouldn't give it to him. So my understanding is that he handled things in a way legally so that he would become the nominee. So that, you know, who knows what will happen with that. Julian Assange every week is saying he's going to, you know, introduce some information. So far, he did get Jeb Wasserman Schultz fired, but he was not able yet to get Hillary Clinton arrested. So that's that.
That is extremely interesting. I had not realized that, and it reminded me of Ron Dellums, who was a friend of mine, was in Congress, and of course was vastly more to the left of virtually anybody there at that time. And there was an episode where one of our spy submarines bumped into a Russian vessel in the Russian harbor. It could have blown up into a international incident. He found out about it, and he handled it in exactly the right way. He did things that were legal and exactly the following the protocols, though he could have, you know, run out to the New York Times and the CNN and blown the lid. And that ended up giving him a great deal more prestige and authority from that point forward that he had had before. So that is I'm very interested to hearing that about what Senator Sanders did.
And then to answer your second question, this is a revolution. Bernie Sanders catalyzed it. I don't know if I would say started it. I would say Occupy Wall Street was take one. They crushed that, the Homeland Security, and it was the Pentagon, I remember which office, the state office. Anyway, had a conference call with many of the mayors of the cities where Occupy Wall Street was and told them basically how to crush it. So that was crushed. But as everyone knows, you can't crush an idea. So Bernie Sanders capitalized on that, rightly so. It was a very intelligent thing for him to do. But now that he has left the center point, it's time for us revolutionaries to continue on. And Jill Stein of the Green Party has all of the platform issues of Bernie Sanders, only more so. For instance, on the topic of war and peace, Bernie Sanders has not come out against drone strikes. I personally am very against drone strikes. Even the generals, many generals in the U.S. military have admitted that drone strikes, they're called targeted assassinations. But they base their intel on cell phone data, meaning the cell phone went here and then it went there and then it was in the same location as this other cell phone. And that to me is not probable cause or even an indictment that somebody is actually a criminal enough that they should be killed. But anyway, that is what they use. And then they do a drone strike on that person and whoever happens to be in that person's vicinity, which is many people. And even the CIA's own records admit that 95% of the people killed in drone strikes were not the targeted person. So that means they were innocent civilians. And even the person that was supposedly the terrorist, maybe not. As one CIA analyst said, this is in the drone papers by the Intercept news outlet, sometimes you've been following someone for 18 months only to find out you've been following his mother. So Jill Stein is against targeted drone assassinations. And also she goes further on several other issues. For instance, student state colleges being free. Of course, Bernie Sanders supports that. But she also supports the forgiveness of all the student loans. And I agree with her because student loan doesn't hurt just the students. It also hurts, for instance, in the medical field. If someone comes out of medical school with several hundred thousand dollars in debt, they can't go work at a free clinic. They can't open up an office and give lots of attention to all their patients. They can't necessarily do alternative medicine that doesn't bring as much profit in. They have to think of their bottom line. They have to think of how am I going to pay my debt off. So it actually hurts the entire field of medicine, and therefore all the people in this country, that the student loans are so high.
For those of you just tuning in, we are Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're talking with Netra Halperin, former Bernie Sanders delegate, and now Jill Stein, Green Party supporter, about the revolution that she said that Bernie Sanders catalyzed and how to keep it going. So let's turn back to that interview, Michael Negler.
Thank you, Stephanie. Netra, as we're running a bit out of time here, I want to ask you one more question. And it's really, I'm asking you to reflect on this. that I agree with you completely that Occupy was the predecessor of the Bernie Sanders revolution. Now, in a way, Occupy, as you say, was crushed. It was a failure. And in a way, Bernie Sanders' bid for the presidency has so far ended up in, well, not in success. I feel, and I'm pretty sure you feel also, that this is not cause for despair, that there is a movement that's testing various possibilities. After all, Occupy was an extreme of grassroots, and Bernie Sanders, what he was doing in a way was much more within the system. And it almost looks as if it's a movement that's groping for that sweet spot between grassroots activism out on the street and office holding. And I'm remembering a famous episode where Martin Luther King convinced LBJ that there had to be a Voting Rights Act. LBJ said to him, "That is a great idea, Martin. Now go out and make me do it." Could you comment on that analysis of mine?
Yeah, I really like that last comment. And I've reminded people of that, that I've heard other presidents say that, that even when a president wants to do the right thing, they need to be able to say to their opponents, look, the citizens made me do it. But regarding what's next for the revolution, I think it's up to each individual to look at what their personal interest is. For instance, if someone is really interested in organic gardening, they could maybe help start a organic garden co-op in their neighborhood. If someone wants to run for office, they, you know, absolutely go ahead. If somebody is really concerned with education, then they can work to create a collective of alternative educators who want something better for our students than we're currently getting. So it just really depends on what your personal interest is. But I would say this is absolutely fantastic what has happened here in the last year. I, as a, I guess, middle-aged person, was really unhappy when I saw that. I felt like, what's wrong with young people? Why aren't they, you know, participating? Don't they care? Well, I was wrong, happily. Young people do care. And they were just waiting for the right moment, the right catalyst to get them energized and activated. So I would say to anybody who is a Bernie Sanders supporter, I encourage you to support Jill Stein. And then I also encourage you now and then after the election, whatever the case happens, to become active in your own community, because it's exactly as Michael said, it's both. I wouldn't even say it's in between, it's both. It's the highest level of our political spectrum and the grassroots. If everybody does as much as they can, given their personal circumstances, to have a political revolution, that's how it's going to happen.
Thank you so much, Netra. You know, I was a college professor for decades, and people would come to me and say, what's wrong with the students? They're not like you guys were in the free speech movement. And I said, they are so full of passion, you cannot believe it, but they need an issue. They need some kind of a sense that what they're going to be doing is making a difference.
Right.
Now, the only other comment I would make is that I totally agree that everybody has their own role to play, but somehow it has to cohere, you know, it has to pull together. And so we at the Meta Center, we have a program called Roadmap, which is designed to do exactly that, put everybody on the same page and come up with a joint strategy. Well, Netra, it's been just delightful talking with you. It's informative and inspiring, and I hope at some point we can have you back again on this program when the revolution has progressed.
Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you, Stephanie. It's been a pleasure for me also.
Thank you. You're very welcome, and enjoy Houston.
Okay. Thank you. I will. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and on today's show, we've been talking with two friends from different parts of the country, one of them having been to the Republican National Convention on a nonviolent peace team to help quell violence on either side to allow for conflict to be peaceful. And that was Elliot Adams from Meta Peace Team. And then we were just talking with Netra Halperin, a former Bernie Sanders delegate, about her work and her participation at the Democratic National Convention. And we had a friend that from the Meta Center go to the Democratic National Convention to try to get some interviews for our show. And we wanted to share one interview in particular on today's show today. And this is from a gentleman who was introduced to this idea of the roadmap. And his name is Joe Zimmick, and he's going to talk a little bit about bringing the movement together into one coherent, cohesive, progressive movement. Let's hear from him.
Right now, the first problem is, will the people newly energized by Bernie Sanders remain committed, or will their negative emotions prevail and cause them to drop out of activism? Will they instead despair and conclude that activism isn't worth the effort? That's my primary worry. The second worry is, how much influence can we have on the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party going forward? We ought to be in a position of a lot of influence, but there's precedent that says we're not, that we'll be taken for granted, we'll be triangulated against, they'll expect our votes, and that we'll fall in line without complaint. So those are the two main concerns.
All right, awesome. And how would you like to see, just in general, like the big picture, where would you like to see the movement go forward?
So going forward, there's going to be people who work inside and people who work outside. I firmly believe that we need a full spectrum approach. So the from the most inside, the people who are completely ensconced in the Democratic Party, political consultants, candidates, direct employees like campaign managers, field directors and field organizers, fundraisers, all that. That's as inside as you can get. And then on the other side of the spectrum, the opposite is people who are not engaged at all in the Democratic Party, but who are engaged in cultural messaging, cultural changes. These are people who may have a disdain for party politics, but are very good at getting people excited about, you know, organic permaculture gardening in their neighborhood. Are really efficient at organizing a local recycling program where there isn't one. Very efficient at connecting people, whether they are in Black Lives Matter or whether they're in showing up for racial justice, to be visible in challenging civil injustice in our society, to help move the cultural dialogue and the cultural sense of what's right and wrong in the direction of moral advancement.
That's fantastic. Great. Now, I know you don't know the roadmap tool very well because I just showed it to you, but just what's your overall impression and how it could be useful for what you're describing?
I'm a big picture perspective person. That's one of my, it's a talent or a tendency or whatever you want to say. And that's what this is, too. This diagram, of course, any circular diagram is great because it shows a cyclic oneness to everything that we do. It's easy to say everything's connected, but it's hard for some people to visualize it. And at the center of all these perceived differences in how we interact with our world is the self, the spiritual development of the self, without which everything else becomes very difficult. Because if we are not ourselves developing our own awareness, developing our own compassion, expanding our, what Ken Wilber calls the circle of care and concern, then finding the energy and the really helpful attitude in engaging with all these other issues becomes very difficult. You totally see it in people when they're willing to give up after a short period of engagement. It's like an infatuation. You know, they find something new, they get totally absorbed in it, but if it doesn't meet their expectations or they fail, then all that fades away instantly. It just drains out. They get hopeless, they get sad, they get angry, frustrated, they throw up their hands, and they may walk away. And that addresses what we were talking about earlier, one of my concerns. But people who are more aware, whether they've cultivated personal spiritual awareness or whether they have gained that awareness through many years of experience, both those ways can help. Those people are less likely to walk away, and they may still experience burnout. I'm experiencing burnout, but I'm still aware of the big picture. It allows me to set my expectations in a way that I'm not emotionally drained. I'm more even, and that allows me to stay involved. It's not going to be the same for everybody, but it's definitely helpful to have that as a reminder. In the center of this diagram is the individual. Whoever is holding the diagram is looking at the center and going, that's me. At the center of my interaction with the world is my development, who I am, because that affects everything else.
For those of you just tuning in, this is Peace Paradigm Radio, and that was an interview with a gentleman at the Democratic National Convention, Joe Zemeck, and he talked a little bit about the Bernie Sanders campaign movement, and then he looked at the project called The Roadmap, which is a systematic effort to help, in particular, folks along progressive lines to unify their strategy. And as he was looking at that, he was describing what are some of the advantages of that kind of a strategy. And I was wondering, Michael, before you get into the news, if you might say a little bit more about what the roadmap is and where people can find more information.
Sure. Well, maybe roadmap is the news. Yes, roadmap is, first of all, as Joe was saying, it's a tool that enables people to visualize our coherence, the fact that even if we're doing an organic gardening in one city here, or many of the other issues that people mentioned, education, restorative justice, what have you, that we are part of one movement. Kenneth Boulding referred to this as the movement towards peace as opposed to the peace movement. In other words, the movement toward peace is something that's happening. It's disconnected. It's not a political entity of the normal kind. So part of the effort here is to have it get that kind of political leverage and social impact that a normal movement does. So if people want to go to our website, metacenter.org, and this is Meta with two T's as opposed to Meta Peace Teams, and then go to the roadmap tab, you'll see the whole thing. The first thing you'll see is a diagram of what we call a mandala that helps you visualize where the various sectors of our efforts fit together. The second thing you'll notice is that one of the most important sectors right up on the top is called new story creation, and this responds to what Joe was just calling cultural messaging. In other words, this is our belief that unless a new vision, a new image of who we are and how we fit into the world is accomplished, none of these political or social arrangements is going to really stick. It's going to make any difference. So then you'll notice that the diagram is based on three concentric circles. And as Joe was saying, the inner circle is you. What is your involvement? How do you develop as a person? Recently, we were remembering that Narayan Desai, when he went as a young man, he was being Gandhi's secretary. He went to Gandhi and said, I really appreciate the importance of the work that I'm doing, but I feel I'm not growing. What should I do? And Gandhi said to him, you've already answered your question, Narayan. If you're not growing in this work, you should move on. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he did. So we feel that the limitations of our personal growth are a limiting factor on our effectiveness in the outside world. And then we structure that effectiveness in two successive waves, if you will. The first is to build constructive program. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that we're just talking about with those issues. And then when we have pretty much loosened up the system, there are going to be stubborn pockets that have to be confronted with nonviolent resistance. Mm-hmm. So the next phase of Roadmap is to pull people together and actually have conversations about what that long-term strategy would look like. Without wanting to scare people, we mentioned that in Sri Lanka in the Sarvodaya movement, they developed a 500-year plan for peace. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just to put things in perspective. Somewhere between our flash-in-the-pan activism and 500-year future, we need to develop a coherent strategy that goes from success to success.
Absolutely, because I like the idea of the 500-year Sarvodaya plan just because it gets us out of this reactionary politics where we're constantly battling for these small gain victories when we can actually say, when we've all decided how we're going to handle conflict, we're going to be working on a totally different level, no matter what our political affiliation with one another. Yeah. So it helps to really incorporate that longer-term thinking, but in practical ways that, you know, it's not a 500-year plan isn't the end. But it, you know, from there, they're also going to be reevaluating in 500 years how things are looking and how people are working together.
Well, what you do, in fact, is you set that distant goal and then you step it back toward your present. It's in increments of maybe 150, 25 years. And so you feel that what you're doing now is part of a very hopeful trajectory.
Yeah. And then also I was thinking, Michael, right before you get into the news, as we think about the three concentric circles of the roadmap of Gandhi's vision for, or Narayan Desai calls it total revolution, where you have the individual, then you have constructive program building the alternatives, and then you have really, you confront the system in nonviolent ways, but in direct action. If you think of, you know, just Gandhi sitting at the spinning wheel, you have all three of those right there, because you have the long-term strategy that includes both direct resistance and constructive program, but you don't have either unless you have the person sitting there.
Yeah.
So the person really is the core of this movement.
That's so true, and I think a lot of people are starting to recognize that. That's where things are different from where they were, quote-unquote, back in my day.
And you have a few minutes for some nonviolence in the news. So why don't you tell us the most important pieces of news from the past week or what's coming up, Michael?
Thank you, Stephanie. Well, so much is happening out there, friends, that it really has been extremely difficult this go around to collect this information. And I want to offer thanks to Daniel Cornwall, who's helping us collect and comment on everything that we're seeing. I wanted to start off with kind of a transitional item, because Emma Roller wrote an article in the New York Times called Bernie's Movement Moves On. And she says, there is no doubt that we, that is Sandernistas, Bernie people, strongly influenced the Democratic platform. Bernie's policies are all over that document. Bernie helped people in this country awaken to the sources of their pain. And this reminded me of an episode in Gandhi's career when he was in London in 1931. He was warned not to go up to Lancashire because he had put so many British mill workers out of work. In his characteristic style, he said, "Wow, let's go there." Well, he didn't say wow, but he said, "I'm going there immediately." And it became one of the most dramatic conversions in the history of nonviolence, where he explained to the people, "You and I have both been victimized by a system that cannot continue." And after less than an hour of talking to them, they were completely on his side. It was quite dramatic. So just to conclude that, she says, everyone is aware of the immensity of the work that is ahead, but we welcome the challenge with eagerness and passion. I'm going to skip around, of course, because of the so much to do and so little time to do it in. But I wanted to, this is kind of personal for me. An episode happened recently where a woman that you may not have heard of, Iram Sharmila, in Manipur, in India, ended a 16-year fast, a 16-year hunger strike. She grew up and lives in Manipur, which is one of the seven sister states in India's northeast. And those states have unfortunately been in a state of insurgency for decades. So in 1958, the Indian government passed a law called the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, AFSPA. And this, as you may not be surprised to hear, did not do anything to reduce the violence. In fact, in the 10 years from 2005 to 2015, more than 5,000 people died from political violence. But this has allowed the Indian Army, which is not the most disciplined army in the world, to carry out things like a massacre which killed 12 people waiting for a bus in Manipur. And it was stimulated by that Sharmila went on a hunger strike. And she was arrested because there's a law making suicide attempts illegal. And she has been in prison for 16 years being force-fed every day. It was very bad for her health. She did not want to see her mother during that whole time because she was afraid that seeing her mother's anguish might break her resolve. So, and then she said, the day AFSPA is repealed, I will eat rice from my mother's hand. Well, it has not been repealed, and the mother's love didn't work, and the letter that I wrote to Sharmila 4 years ago saying, we don't want to get stuck in one technique. You've done this. You've carried it to its logical conclusion. Hasn't quite brought the results you want, but it has made you a well-known figure. Now stop the strike, I argued. Go ahead and take food and run for office. Well, my letter didn't apparently have any effect. Mother's love didn't have any apparent effect, but love had an effect. Sharmila is going to get married and run for office. I think this is a very good outcome. And it does highlight the issue how when we are stuck in a limited number of techniques, we can often run into a dead end. And we need to have the flexibility to discriminate between what is a technique and what is a principle. Great. So what I usually do at the outset of the news report is to mention some resources, and I want to mention again the Nonviolence Training Hub, which is put up by Campaign Nonviolence. They had a goal, have still a goal of 1,000 trainings this year, and 564 of them have already happened. And because training is such an important preparation for us, whether we're going to be on a peace team or whatever role we're going to play, I would like people to go to the CNV website and look at the Nonviolence Training Hub and see if maybe there is one in your neighborhood or you'd like to organize one. Then moving on, while he was working with something called Action Aid International, which is a global civil society federation, a Danish activist named Søren Warburg noticed a very significant shortcoming within the global community of nonviolent activists, a lack of ideas, and a lack of resource sharing. So he did something to overcome that, and in the end it became a book called Beautiful Trouble. Mm-hmm. And I believe if you subscribe to Waging Nonviolence, you may get that book as a gift. And this is something that I actually was saying in my nonviolence course for a long, long time. Militarism has such good education and such good training, and we do not have anything comparable on the peace side. Mm-hmm. So we are starting to overcome that. We're starting to emerge from that. Mm-hmm. There are, in fact, a lot of books that are coming out. And let me remind you again about Nonviolent Conflict News. It does give at least some political news, while it's not maybe a very in-depth analysis on nonviolence. But Robert Burrows, also a friend of ours in the nonviolent movement in Popular Resistance, had an article called Ending Human Violence is a Task for Each of Us, and that lists a lot of resources. I want to say that a good friend of ours who has been on this program, Rivera Sun, tells us that she's been working with Native American groups up north, and the crew has stopped several mines, a naval base, a radioactive race waste dump, and asserted treaty rights, all using nonviolent action. We hope to give you more of that report in programs to come.
Thank you very much for your news, Michael Nagler and co-host. So we want to thank everybody who made this show possible today, Peace Paradigm Radio. Thank you to our mother station, KWMR, as well as to our show's underwriters. And we want to thank our guests as well, Elliot Adams and Netra Halperin, and all of the volunteers and staff at the Meta Center for Nonviolence. Thank you very much. All of our listeners, again, thank you. And until the next time, everybody, take care of one another.